Welcome to the Talk Theater in Chicago podcast, your audio source for what's going on in the Chicago theater scene. This is the episode for January 26th, 2009, and on this week's episode, we have a special interview with actor Brian Dennehy. Also, we have Chicago's theater news for you, so get ready, and let's talk theater.
This is Tom Williams, and you are listening to Talk Theater in Chicago's interview podcast. Our special guest this week is the legendary actor, film star, television star, and, of course, star of the stage, Mr. Brian Dennehy. Thank you so much for doing this interview.
I do supermarket openings, too. Wear the clown suit, wave the people in off the street, I'll do anything.
Okay. Tell us about Desire Under Elms and what got you interested in coming back to Chicago. And by the way, welcome back.
Oh, thank you. Well, it's probably the last O'Neill play that I can do that I'm age appropriate for that Bob and I have not done, and except maybe for a remounting of Iceman Cometh, which we're talking about, where I would play Larry Slade and not Hickey, but that's early in the conversational stage at this point. So, but this would probably be the last original O'Neill production for us that we could do together. Ephraim Cabot is 76. I'm 70, but I could easily be 76 or even 86 for that matter, the way I feel these days. And it's a play that was written by O'Neill in 1924 after his first huge flush of success in the late teens with Beyond the Horizon and a few other plays that they had written. He had already won a Pulitzer Prize. He was the first, actually, numerically and literally and rhetorically, the first serious American playwright, very much influenced by Ibsen and Strindberg, by the Abbey Theater, by the Moscow Art Theater, but no Americans, interestingly enough, had written what might be called a serious American play before Eugene O'Neill. So when he appeared on the scene in the late teens, it was regarded as obviously a fresh voice, a powerful voice. And Desire Under the Elms came early on in his career. He was about 36 perhaps at that time, and he was still writing plays about the other. He was still writing plays. He had not entered the phase that he entered into in the late 30s when he began to write about himself and his family, and those of course are generally regarded as his masterpieces. Plays like Iceman Cometh, Long Day's Journey, Moon for the Misbegotten, and so forth, which were created in a burst of activity from about 1937, 38 to about 1945. This was 1924. He was still writing. He wrote plays like Emperor Jones, Harry Ape, Marco Millions. And this play was a play that came hard on the heels of all the members of his family dying within the previous 2 years. His mother died. His father died first, his mother died, and then his brother died. All of them tragically, and all of them with, of course, a tremendous story, which he told later on in Long Day's Journey. And this play had a lot to do with the Bible reading that he had done, the study of Greek mythology that he had done, and most importantly, his early work in Freud and Jung. He was one of the first Americans to seriously read the work that was being done mainly in Europe and Austria.
That was certainly part of your character.
Yeah, I mean, he's quite a bit. He, well, it's not only that. I mean, the relationship between Eben my son, and Abby, his stepmother. There is a scene in the play where she essentially seduces her stepson, certainly suggesting incest, if not actual incest, where she seduces him by saying to him, just think of me as your mother. Now, that was pretty shocking stuff for 1924. In fact, the play was not actually allowed to be produced in many places because of those elements of the play, which O'Neill was specifically writing about. There are very complicated reasons for that, some of which have to do with his own mother and his brother and his brother's relationships with his mother and so forth. Not that they were incestuous, but they were certainly complicated. In any case, the play was written as a result of his enormous immersion into all of these elements, the Bible, Greek mythology, psychology, and it's also his interest in American history, the fact that later on he devised this idea of writing the cycle plays, which would be the whole American experience, excuse me, from the Revolution on. He never really got into that, but this is certainly part of what he was thinking about in those days.
So tell us about your character and how you prepare
Cabot,
for it.
Interestingly enough, O'Neill later on, towards the end of his life, when asked which of the characters that he wrote most closely resembled himself, aside from Edmund in Long Day's Journey, which, of course, was him at an early age, 22 or 23, he said that the one character that he felt most closely resembled him was Ephraim Cabot, a monomaniacal New England farmer whose curse it was to be completely involved with this farm and this work that he had done, this very, very difficult work of making this farm productive, this New England farm, very rocky soil, making it productive and working for 50 years to do that. And the analogy, of course, is with O'Neill and his work, which was very hard for him, very difficult, very painful to produce. And the fact that he sacrificed, O'Neill did, virtually everything around him in order to do that work, including his family, and most importantly, his family. His relationships with his children were terrible. He complains about his father in Long Day's Journey, but his father was a much better father than Eugene O'Neill ever was. And he understood that he had made tremendous sacrifices, not only of himself, but of the people around him that he should have loved and should have cared for in order to do this work. Well, that's very close to who and what Ephraim Cabot is. And when he wrote it, I don't think he was as aware as he was later on of the commitment, the unbelievable commitment that he had to this 800-pound gorilla that he lived with, which was his writing. But he certainly became aware of it later, made all kinds of sacrifices to it, as Ephraim Cabot does.
Yeah, it says Ephraim ends up with this young wife, his third wife. And a little bit about the story, he kind of swindled the farm from his youngest son.
Well, we don't know about that.
We don't know.
It's
okay.
It's never really, it's very hard to find that out. He doesn't feel that he swindled it. It may well be that he married his second wife, Eben's mother, in order to solve a legal problem that may have existed with her parents, which is why Eben insists that the farm, now, since his mother is dead, the farm is his and not his mother's. But everybody in this play has a rationalization of who they are.
And they're all a little greedy, too.
Everybody is selfish. Everybody is self-absorbed. Everybody regards everybody else as some form of a possession or somebody who needs to be screwed, literally or rhetorically, and sometimes both. And it's one of O'Neill's early plays about possession. And possession is not just money and property. It can also be sex. And it can be ownership of people in addition to property. So there are no heroes in this play. Nobody comes out ahead. They're all sinners. They're all human beings.
Would you consider it a tragedy?
Oh, yeah, it's a tragedy, sure. Because everybody loses. And it is a deep, deep tragedy. It's a Greek tragedy in its conception and in the way that it ends. It's very, very much... Of course, Ephraim goes on. He goes on with this work, this endless work.
He's an endless survivor, isn't he?
Well, he's a survivor, but of course he's badly damaged. And as he says constantly, he talks about being alone and being lonesome. Of course, he never makes the calculation that one of the reasons why he's alone and lonesome is because of the way he treats other people. Because he uses them. He uses them as they were a resource, as they were the land. He uses people the same way. And so he is the as we all are, the architect of his own loneliness, of his own disaster. It's a complicated, layered play. It's much more complicated than people think it is. And it's one of the difficulties of always doing O'Neill is that you have to do archaeology. You have to do the major earth moving to reveal the structure, and then you got to start using shovels, and then you finally wind up using brushes to brush away the dust to try to figure it all out. But it just keeps getting deeper and deeper and deeper and deeper. O'Neill was, even at this stage of his life, a great, great artist who understood how deep and how complicated life was. That's why he studied the Greeks. That's why he studied Freud and Jung, because he wanted to try to understand more and more about the psychological, the emotional depths of human beings, so he could write about them.
So let me ask you this. How do you prepare to play one of these deep characters who obviously you have much respect for?
Well, of course, what makes it interesting is is realizing that so much of Ephraim Cabot, whether he was aware when he wrote it or not, but so much of Ephraim Cabot is Eugene O'Neill, and it's kind of interesting to try to get into that head of O'Neill, who was driven, absolutely driven to write, and whose life was a melancholy pursuit of this work that he just by the last 10 or 15 years of his life, productive years, because he lived 10 or 12 years after he stopped writing, which were horrible years for him. But the last 10 or 12 years of his productive life, all he did was write. He didn't really care where he lived or how he lived. He had relationships with people, but they all had to do with his work, his writing. Like most great artists, he understood that he only existed in terms of his art. Picasso was like that. Robert Frost was like that. Great artists have this compulsion to do what they do because they know they're in its thrall. Their lives are lived for that and for nothing else.
Do you think it's necessary for you to have that kind of compulsion to play one of his major characters?
I'm not a great artist by any means.
Well, a lot of us think you are.
I'm a kind of a half-ass actor, which is a whole different thing. But let's put it this way. I'm not a great artist, but I play one on TV once in a while. Or on stage, it's interesting to try to get into these lives, to try to understand the compulsion that drives a person like Ephraim Cabot, and parenthetically, a person like Eugene O'Neill, the necessity to do this work, and the fact that you have no choice and that everything must be sacrificed to it. I don't have that kind of a life, and I wouldn't want it, but it's kind of interesting to try to explore it once in a while.
Yeah, I would think it makes you get into depths to realizing things about yourself that you might not have realized.
Well, the whole point, that's really the point of theater. The point of theater, of any art, a mile from here, less, is the Chicago Art Institute. There's libraries around here. There's bookstores. There are movie theaters to some extent do the same thing, but only serious movies. The point is, whether it's music or art or writing or theater, and the reason why someone like myself pursues great parts like O'Neill is because if you do it right, if you can get a piece of it, somebody in the audience, not everybody, not all of them, maybe not even a majority, maybe only a few, will come out of the theater understanding more about themselves. It's a given that they'll understand more about the play. It's a given that they'll understand something more about Eugene O'Neill. But the real point of art is that somebody goes out of the theater saying, I see something about myself. I understand something about myself that I didn't understand when I walked in here.
That's the
point of a great museum, the point of a great music hall. That's the real point, a shared emotional and intellectual realization on the part of an audience. Doesn't happen very often, but when it does happen, and it has happened, I've had people talk to me about things that they've realized about themselves or their father or their brothers.
One comes to mind for me is your performance in Death of a Salesman here in Chicago.
Yeah, well, of course, that's a common... it happens more in salesmen, I think, than...
I was in sales at the time when I saw it.
Yeah. It's because everybody knows somebody like Willie, or is somebody like Willie, or his father was somebody like Willie, or their brothers were somebody like Biff. Miller understood something instinctively about the American condition, and he wrote about it in Death of a Salesman unforgettably. So.
Well, that begs the question of working with Bob Falls. You guys have done quite a few collaborations.
Yep.
And two of them have led to some nice awards for you when you ended up in New York. But for Chicago to be honored with two such great artists, and you guys seem to be in sync. You've worked together in so many great productions.
Well, that doesn't mean that we don't fight, because we do fight like hell about a lot of stuff. But we try to always fight with the idea of getting closer to the meaning of the play. And what it is that O'Neill or Miller or Brecht or whoever is setting out to do. And it has been a very close and a very productive relationship. And I hope it continues. This is probably the end of the line of, as far as O'Neill is concerned. And I'm getting pretty close to the end of any line at 70. But who knows? You know, there may be another couple of shots in there.
But... So how did you get this role? Did you and Bob agreed you wanted to do it, or how did it happen?
Everybody thinks that it's some kind of a massive coordination of, and it's really not. Typically what's happened in the past, and then right from the beginning, and it's always been the case, he'll call and say, how about Iceman coming? I'll say, yeah, let's do it. And that's it. Touch of the Poet, I wasn't even familiar with at all until I started working on it, and I was appalled by how difficult it was when I realized
that is a tough show.
I had committed to it, but at the same time, very interesting and worth doing, as is this one. But usually it's a very casual beginning of these things, and it turns out to be a lot more than casual eventually, as it is right now in the midst of the final birth pangs here. But no, it always starts out much less significant than you think it would be. When we talked about Salesman, it was we had always agreed that we would try to do things that were impossible, but nobody did. And for reasons that were obvious, nobody did them. Like Iceman Cometh and like Galileo and Touch of the Poet. So Salesman was different because it had been done so often and so well. And yet, both of us realized it was a great play, a great American play, needed to be done. And he thought maybe we could do something different with it, and it turns out that we did.
Yeah, and
it never starts out that way. It always starts out as a kind of an idea.
Kind of an idea. Well, let me ask you this. How would you compare Chicago audiences with the Broadway or the London audiences?
Well, Chicago audiences are great. The thing about this town, it's a great town. It's the best city in America. There's no question about that. No city's even close. And I speak as one who lives on the East Coast and was raised, educated in New York, and I still live near New York. But this is the best city in America. And the thing that's great about this city is, and its audiences, is that there is a, you're not confronted with an ironic audience, with an audience that is looking for the real meaning of plays. The audiences come in Chicago and they either like a play and they respond to it or they don't. The kind of thing that works in New York sometimes is kind of a wink and a, you know, we're going to make fun of this now. We're going to make fun of these people because that's what we do. We're New Yorkers. We're ironic. We see the twists and the turns and everything. In Chicago, they love the theater. They care about the theater. They care about ideas. They care about performance. They care about being moved, but it's a very direct connection. Either the connection is made or it's not made.
So they look for the truth.
Yeah, they want the truth, but they want it undiluted, and they want it, they don't need it to be strained through somebody's filter of irony. The one problem with irony is for people who are suffused with irony, there is no truth.
That's true.
There isn't anything real. It's all just opinions. Mm-hmm. It's all relative. Everything is relative. So that attitude doesn't exist in Chicago the way it does in New York. Makes it a hell of a lot easier if you're trying to be an artist and say, this is the truth. Understand this about yourself. Understand this about O'Neill. Here's the truth right here. It's not filtered through all this moral relativism or whatever. This is it. Take it or not. You don't have to accept it as the truth.
Kind of a Midwest mentality, you might say, huh?
I like it. I find it very refreshing. The audiences either accept it or they don't. I'm not sure how they're reacting to this.
Well, speaking of audiences, I have to ask you this because so many people have mentioned about, I know you've had several incidents where, and we've all had, where cell phones go off on the show. Mm. But there was a famous incident back a few years ago. I believe it was here at the Goodman about a cell phone going off and somebody answering it or...
I don't know. They all run together. Okay. I'm not even sure where it happened or what happened. I've had a few times where I stopped the show and I just said, answer it or turn it off or go back and get it or whatever. It's more frustrating than anything else. I mean, there are examples of actors getting furious about it. And, it depends upon when it happens. It happens, as it has happened in a couple of plays, where it's a critical moment and you want the audience to be right with you, and they are right with you, and all of a sudden the phone goes off. I usually give them three rings. If it rings three times and it stops, I keep going. If it goes more than three rings, I stop. I say, please deal with that, whatever it is. And I try to deal with it with humor. One time I said to the guy, or whoever it was, I hope you're an obstetrician. Somebody's calling about a baby being delivered. But in many cases, I'll just say, okay, we're going to go back a few lines and we're going to try to pick it up again. Because obviously the concentration, the line has been broken and you have to reestablish it, and you never really do. Look, it's a modern world. It is what it is. And you got to deal with the way it is. And what are you going to do about it? Try to bring an audience along and move them. Everybody always says, cell phones are really great disturbances, and they are to some extent. But the funny thing is, the real point of it all is that most actors, most serious actors, are not really working for laughs, although obviously there are times when you want laughs. And they're not really working for applause, although obviously there are times when you want applause. What a real actor is working for is silence. What a real actor is working for is 800 people not making any noise at all. When 800 people are listening to you and listening to the playwright, and they're not moving their program around, they're not shifting around in their seat, they're not clearing their throat or coughing, that's when you've done your job. And there's absolute silence in the house. So that when a cell phone goes off in that, obviously, it's very destructive and upsetting. But you know what? Ain't the end of the world. You go back.
Well, I'm glad you said, but I'm glad you said it had to be said because unfortunately that keeps happening.
Oh, yeah. Sure. And it always will.
Yeah. So tell us now, in the remaining time we have, what are some of the roles? Two questions. What are some of the roles you're proudest of? And what are some of the roles you'd like to do? You still have on your chart that you'd like to do?
Oh, I don't know. I don't know what. It's hard to answer that question. The one thing about being a stage actor is that what I do, what we all do, is, without trying to be too pretentious about it, what we all do is fundamentally and genuinely existentialist. It exists. It has importance while you're doing it. It has very little importance, really, what I did last year or 2 years ago or 10 years ago or whatever. Does that mean that I'm not proud of it? No, it doesn't mean that. I care about it, and I'm glad that people remember it and are affected by it. But the thing about theater is that it happens now. It happens tonight, or it doesn't, and it may not. But the thing that's unique about the theater is that what happens in the theater can only happen in the theater. It can't happen in a movie. It can't happen in television. It can't. You may see a good movie. You may see a good television show. But what happens in the theater is a real person on stage creating or recreating an emotional and an intellectual moment, a context, which you respond to or don't respond to. That can only happen in the theater. Now, the theater may, in fact, serious theater may, in fact, be dying. I don't know. It's always dying one way or another. But if it does die, off, something will be lost that cannot be achieved anyplace else.
I couldn't agree with
it
you.
It can't be achieved. I don't give a damn how good the movies are, how good the television is, how good the computer is, how good the CGI is. It's not going to be recreated. It will not come back. So, in a way, I'm glad to be 70, because I can do this for the next 3 or 4 years or whatever it is, hopefully have some moments, some people who will respond to it, because the response and what I do is unique to the theater. And when the theater dies, as I assume it probably will at some point, or becomes a museum art like Ukrainian folk dancing, that will be the end of it. But it'll also be the end of that impact. It'll also be the end of that artistic influence.
Well, I believe as long as actors of your caliber still come from doing, I know you've done over 40 films, back on stage, and we have places like the Goodman Theater and directors
well,
like
that's
Bob
the
Falls. Yes,
see, that's the importance of regional theater, the importance of not-for-profit theater, the importance of regional theater, especially a good one like the Goodman, is that it is not, it doesn't depend purely on the commercial aspects of it. It depends upon donations. It depends upon people wanting to experience something that they can't experience anyplace else, except maybe at the Steppenwolf or some of the other theaters in Chicago. It depends upon those people wanting to have those experiences and wanting to have make sure that there is an institution which can provide those experiences, because they are unique. They don't even exist across the street. And I'm glad Wicked is running, and I hope it runs forever. It's not the same thing. It's not the same thing as Desire Under the Elms. It's not the same thing as Iceman Cometh. It's never going to be the same thing. And that's why these places are so important. They're important for our children, although our children may not realize it at the time, because when those things are not done anymore, that'll be the end of an entire art form.
Well, thank you so much. I could not have had a better spokesman for the power of theater than what you have just mentioned in the last few minutes.
Anybody's listening.
They'll be
they're
listening.
All wondering what Paris Hilton's doing.
No, I think they'll all be at the Goodman Theater. And Desire Under Realms opens on the 26th and runs through March 1st. And Brian, thank you so much
for giving me
the time and for your insights.
I appreciate it. Thanks.
Thank you, folks. And go see a play this week.
Hello, Chicago, and welcome to the Talk Theater in Chicago News Podcast. I'm your host, Dustin Moat, bringing you the theater news for the week of January 26th, 2009. Broadway in Chicago has announced the return engagement of August, Osage County, the Pulitzer Prize and Tony Award-winning play that tells the funny and entertaining story of the Weston family of Pawhuska, Oklahoma. August Osage County comes to Chicago's Oriental Theater for a limited two-week engagement running February 2nd through the 14th of 2010. Written by Pulitzer Prize winner Tracy Letts, who also wrote Superior Donuts, Killer Joe, and Bug, the show is also being directed by Tony Award winner Anna DeShapiro. August Osage County is a rare large-scale theatrical event that originally premiered at Steppenwolf back in 2007. The show opened in London to rave reviews last November, and it will now be a part of the 2010 Broadway in Chicago season subscription series. Subscribers will have the opportunity to purchase the tickets beginning in April. Tickets will go on sale to the public at a later date to be announced, so stay tuned right here to Talk Theater in Chicago. Bob the Builder Live, Spud's Big Mess, will be making a stop in Chicago for two performances on Saturday, February 7th at the legendary Chicago Theater. It is Bob the Builder's first touring show in the United States in 5 years. It's based on the popular TV show that airs on PBS Kids, and Bob the Builder Live is a singing and dancing extravaganza for budding builders and their families. The show stars Bob the Builder, his business partner Wendy, the trusty machine team members of Scoop, Dizzy, Lofty, and Scrambler, and other favorite friends from Sunflower Valley. Can they all pull together and get the job done? Yes, they can! The 90-minute show features 10 original songs and encourage habits such as taking care of the earth and recycling. Tickets for this kid's show are currently available. Follow the links on Talk Theater in Chicago's Theater News section. Chicago Shakespeare Theater's international programming initiative, the World Stage Series, brings Michael Pennington's one-man show, Sweet William, February 3rd through the 22nd, upstairs at Chicago Shakespeare. As one of England's foremost Shakespearean actors, Michael Pennington builds on the facts that are known about Shakespeare's life and from the plays themselves, and then goes on to create a portrait of a man in a tour de force performance with only a chair and a red handkerchief on stage. Sweet William begins its limited engagement on February 3rd. For more information on how to purchase tickets, visit our news section. Thank you for listening to the Talk Theater in Chicago News Podcast. Remember, you can find us here every Monday with more news ready for you to enjoy. So, until next Monday, that is the theater news from Talk Theater in Chicago, and I'm your host, Dustin Moat. Thank you for listening to the Talk Theater in Chicago podcast. I would like to thank Brian Dennehy for giving us the honor of interviewing him this week. I would also like to thank Tom Williams and Mark Meyer. Without them, this podcast would not be possible. And I would also like to thank you, our listening audience. Remember, we will be here every Monday with a new episode ready for your listening pleasure. So, until next Monday, I'm your host, Dustin Moat, reminding you, Chicago, to keep talking theater.